Blog Talk Radio.
Is kind of eerie and haunting. It is Sequentia by Susan Alexandra, and it's your DNA set to music. Your DNA only has four notes to it, A, B, C, and D. And so with those four notes, the combinations make every other note. I love this music. It's indescribable, but it's Susan Alexandra. Sequentia, Sequencia. Well, we thank you for being with us today on Sound Health Options. We're coming to you from Blog Talk Radio. It's August 8th, 2010. Richard is with us again. How you doing, Richard?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Thank you.
We're not going to be video broadcasting, but we'll return to that next week. We do have some links posted for you on the chat. Richard, can you tell people how to get to that?
Sure. Those will be on drop.io/nanovoice, N-A-N-O-V-O-I-C-E. By the end of the show, I'll have those posted at that drop site.
And I noticed that you are interested in dengue fever. There is an outbreak of that in Florida. Comes from a mosquito bite. Very, very painful from what I have heard and what we posted here. You know, anything that gets thrown at us, we can figure it out. We can give you the frequency antidotes for it. We've been able to look at the base pairs of genes and all the proteins that go with it and be able to decode what's actually going on. I need to get back to my switchboard here. And
I'm very excited about the dengue information because I have a friend who has many family members in the Philippines, and in the Philippines dengue is a major issue because of water source pollution and all sorts of a combination of events. And they have no money, not just his people, but in the Philippines is very poor. So a solution is really exciting to hear about.
I need to call out to our guest. I guess we got dropped off the line here.
I could complain about something for a minute while you do that.
Yes, could you do that? Absolutely. Go ahead and complain.
I'd like to complain about the media. And what my complaint is in this moment is I am disgusted. I'm not surprised, I'm sad to say, but I'm disgusted by the fact that because, as they used to say in media, if it bleeds, it leads, that the Gulf is seems to be mostly disappeared from the media. It's like it's no longer an issue. They can't see anything. That's the reports that are coming out of the Gulf. Oh, we don't see any more oil. We don't see any issues. We don't see any problems. So, therefore, it's no longer...
Hello?
Hold on 1 second, Richard. Eric, this is Sherry from...
Yeah, hi, Sherry. How are you?
Blog Talk Radio. We're on the air right now having trouble trying to dial out to you. So, just hang on for a minute, okay?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, Richard.
Just that, you know, it's as if the Gulf issue has just... You know, that the stuff that's being put out by the, not the press, but by the media of the machine that controls what's happening in the Gulf, BP or whoever you want to say it is, that it's because we no longer see, supposedly, the oil and the water, that it's not a problem, and or that there aren't, as if there aren't tens of thousands of people that are jobless because of the destruction of the seafood, and, as I said last week, the fact that... fool in charge of the FDA has said that, oh, yes, the seafood from the Gulf is just fine now. because it's been sniffed and tested that it's clean to eat. You know, whatever that is, I'm curious as to what they feel are required daily requirement for, you know, Corexidus or other toxic surfactants. I'll get off my soapbox because I can write complain about that.
I don't believe any of them anymore. We did that article to send out the antidotes with using the right frequencies, and that is available, by the way, as the front page article on soundhealthoptions.com. It is a new website. It just went up on Friday, and we'd like you to look at that, any of you, and tell us if you find any kinks or arrows in it. We're trying to do all of this on a very tight budget here. Richard, we do have a guest this week. We try to alternate between a guest and other kinds of shows. Our special guest is the author of Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. You know, we don't come into the world with a reference manual, and our guest, Eric Maisel, is going to bring us information about how we can have dominion over our own brain. Boy, that's a tall order. We'll be with our guests in a few minutes. We just got a couple of audience things that we need to talk about. And, Richard, you know, just jump in here anywhere.
All right.
We'd like to take a poll, and this was at Richard's suggestion, because he keeps saying, I want more bioacoustic stuff, but the people here keep saying, Sherry, it's going to be easier on you if you do interviews. And it really is. When I interview somebody, I get to read this wonderful book, and, you know, that's just kind of sit down and have a relaxing time. But when we do these vocal profiling ones, I have to do a lot of work. So we'd like to hear from you. You can write to me at Sherry, Sharry, on air at gmail.com, or you can call into the show and let us know about what's going on. Richard, do you want in on this? Want to be writing to you, too?
Sure. People can write to me at research at Enviro. Actually, let me change this. I'm sorry. Have them email me at talktomeguy, because it's ever so much easier to remember. Talktomeguy, just like it sounds, TalkMeguy. At gmail.com.
Okay, and they could also write to you at the chat here, and you could kind of take a little poll while we're on the air.
Yes, that's right. We can be chatting while we're on air.
Okay, great. We have a lot of guests today. This is good. I need to remind you that we're being brought to you from the studios of Sound Health and the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology. We're a nonprofit registered 501c3, the largest alternative research center in Ohio, and our research centers around vocal profiling, and that's just taking a sample of your voice and then being able to tell you what's going on with you. I want to tell a story that happened this week. It's such an incredible story in the lab, and I'll tell you what we really do instead of this little announcement I'm supposed to read. We had a 4-year-old boy come in, and his diagnosis was Tourette's syndrome. Now, Tourette's, they have a lot of tics, and, you know, with adults, sometimes they just spew a lot of bad language and muscle twitches and things like that. Well, we ran him through our computer program after taking a sample of his voice, and he had a score of 1 on Tourette's, and you have to have at least a 4 for us to even look at it. So we asked the computer, what does this kid really have? And it came up. He ended up with a 17 score on epilepsy. And we began to look at the kind of epilepsy he had and what was really going on with it. And this is a form of epilepsy that deals with B6. And that's a whole other story that we're going to tell you about next week, because it's just phenomenal. If we have time, I'll talk about it today a little bit. But we were able to look at this kid and figure out that the epilepsy was a vitamin deficiency, and it dealt with homocysteine and B6. And his mom said, oh, I have that too. I can't deal with homocysteine very well. So we ran the mom through. Sure enough, she had the same cascade out. And then she said, you know, my mom has this. So we're able to look at this whole cascade in this family and back it off. And it's as simple as giving them frequencies that will help them use B6. Now, this four-year-old kid is now saved from having to go through all of this testing and brain scans and maybe even a life where they weren't going to find it, because it's kind of a rare type of epilepsy. But to be able to do that for an entire family just is kind of phenomenal. So I wanted to share that story. We have any comment, Richard?
I think that's it's just another example. This is why I'm pro. My part of the poll is still supporting you. I'm sorry to say doing more work. Because it's this kind of, I mean, you do this on a daily basis, but it's this kind of information that I think is so stunning. To have a kid who has been put in the category of saying that he has Tourette's, to then have it reviewed and find, oh, no, it's a state of imbalance in his system. This will help balance his system. And then he's not only radically faster, better, but that he's actually figured out instead of being put into a pile of, oh, you have that, here, take this. I think that's awesome.
That's the beauty of what we do here. We're able to look at the whole person through this big mathematical grid of how the brain works. It's phenomenal. Okay, we need to hurry through some of our questions because I really want to get to our author. We've gotten something from Stephen Green who wants us to look at Senate Bill 510 that will make it illegal to grow, share, sell anything about homegrown food. And we've given that in the chat room, the link to that, I think, yeah, it's there. It's the first link. So go and look at that because it's just silliness. But I think with all this other stupid silliness that's going on, it's going to pass, and it's just crazy. I'm going to talk about something our author said about this, too, just in a minute. Okay, that's one. So go look at that, write to your congressman and say, is this true? I'm not allowed to grow tomatoes on my porch anymore? Can't have a garden? You know, that really restricts us in being self-sufficient. And I think that is a God-given, or whoever gives us that. That's a right to be self-sufficient, to go out and pick dandelion greens out of your yard and you know, make a salad. So this bill is crazy. I don't know who's behind it. He says Monsanto is, because they want to control all the seeds, but I don't really know. Okay, quickly now. Shannon sent us a tip of the day, which I thought was great. No judgment is about you. If you react, you make it about you instead of what it is really about, what the other person needs, what the relationship needs, or what you said or did that may have created hurt or separation. I just think that was incredible. And you can just jump right in here anytime, Richard. And three, this one, you heard it here first. Remember back in March when we said Pelosi's announcement that the health bill would pass was because the people wanted it, and we said that was hogwash, and she was totally lying, and she knew it? Well, Fox News picked up on that, and they think that she is hogwash. So, you know, I don't think everything they come out with is great and wonderful, but they said they now know that she was lying and floating on thin ice. I don't believe everything Fox said, like I said, but here's a flash. Most announcers on Fox are attempting to support a Republican takeover in November. I think that would be good. I'll get some of this Obama crap out of there. But I did an evaluation of their announcers, and they know that they're pushing the boundaries, and not all of what they're saying is true. They're intentionally leaving out things. Their intention is to lead their station to a new Congress, not lead their station, but be the leading station toward a new Congress. They think that's going to curry favor. They want to stand out and be different. Yes, they are. They want to lead the nation in opinion and what to believe. So don't believe everything you see on Fox. They are intentionally trying to create the idea of a Republican takeover. Not a bad idea, but they're doing it by slanting things. An important one here, dengue fever. We've given you those. We're going to announce that, and we will put out an article just like we did about the BP spill antitoxins. You know, Richard, you may be right. I would like you to be right about, now that we put out all the antidotes, everything about it has kind of disappeared. I don't think we're that powerful, but I'd like to think we are.
I think that would be fabulous if that was really why it disappeared.
Yeah. We're also we'll have that next week for you, and we'll have the article, and we're going to have some statements, evaluation by Michael Bloomberg about this fight about the mosque. So, Kenny, we will be doing that next time. A question, there was somebody sent us this information and said they're selling drugs on CD, like marijuana and cocaine and blah, 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 blah. Yes, these people in January started sending me emails about how many suckers there are on the planet and that they've sold nearly $12 million of these drug CDs. They're digital. It's probably all in your mind anyway. I can't say don't get involved, but it's just silliness. Okay, and number five, and I know you're going to have something about this, Richard. There was a new Geraldo show last night, and they advertised it all week about Lady Gaga's sexual self-restraint. And they didn't advertise any of the rest of the stuff that was on the show, just that. You know, this idea of sex sells, sex sells, sex sells. Her shows are mostly sexual. Have you ever seen any of her videos?
Yes, I have.
The last one I saw.
I have a sort of a footnote comment that oddly enough ties together Geraldo and Fox News.
Okay.
Part of the thing we forget about media or news or any of it, it's all about revenue. We shouldn't ever forget that it's about how much money each of those places is generating. It's not about, I mean, yes, the reporters may believe that they have an agenda, but I can guarantee you that if there's an OJ SUV out driving on the freeway, somebody's going to be chasing it to make sure that they get that story on the air first, because it's what brings in the revenue. It's all about advertising dollars and eyes on the screen. It's not about content. The content is the secondary thing. It's about, well, it is about the content, but the content is the target for how much money they can make off that content.
I believe it, because it was, all of it was this buildup about Lady Gaga's sexual self-restraint.
Yes, yes.
And I should have watched the videos. I recorded part of this. I'm going to go back and watch the commercials and see who is supporting this kind of junk.
Yeah.
The last video I saw of her was of naked men crawling on the ground like dogs, and they were all at her command with a little whip. Now, you can't tell me that sexual self-restraint, maybe just entertainment, and she's not like that at all. Okay,
She may be like that, but she knows what sells.
Yes. You know, and any of these four or five things that we've said, we could have had a radio show on any of them. We just sort of tease people here like they do
on media, right?
On media. Our next Guardian of the People meeting is August 15th. It's going to be about post-traumatic stress disorder in support of our project about supporting returning soldiers. So if you know anybody who has this issue, please get in touch with us or them about getting involved. Just go to Guardians, that's plural, guardiansofthepeople.com. Have you got your stuff signed in yet, Richard?
Yes, I do.
All right.
I'm happy and good to go.
And remember that each person, each member, will get a public computer program each month. And this month it's going to be about post-traumatic stress disorder, so you can put a microphone in front of these people and see if there's any biochemical issues and why they can't cope with stress. You know, when you're in a state of war, you use up your hormones, and your body gets abused emotionally, mentally. It's like being in a state of flight or fright all of the time. In looking at the stuff that's going on around the world, this is my soapbox for the minute, it's reminding me that the shape the government's in and what they're trying to do, it's reminding me of the movie with Jim Carrey where he becomes God. I don't remember the name of it. But he plays around with being God and makes messes of people's lives because he doesn't see the consequences. He changes what he doesn't like. He enhances his sex life. It's funny, but it's also pathetic. Oh, Bruce Almighty. Okay, thanks. It's pathetic that that's what's happening with our government. And we don't have any control. But our guest today, Eric Mazel, is a creative coach and columnist, and he's going to talk to us about getting some of that control back. He's going to talk about his book, Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. He's collaborated with Ann Mazel on this book, his wife, and they're going to tell us some really kind of far-out stuff, I think. It's where we would put people on the fringe, and he says, no, that's really normal. So welcome to the show, Eric. Well, do I have his mic turned on? I don't. That's really awful. Eric, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. It was me. I just didn't have your mic turned on.
I was saying that I don't have any clues about controlling the government.
Well, I think you have a lot of clues about controlling ourselves. So I'm going to read a comment from your book, which it's on page 2. So you get into deep things quickly. It says, honey, let's spend a few hours thinking. Your husband doesn't ask, dear, what big ideas are you working on? Indeed, if it could be put to a vote, thinking might well be outlawed. Expect such a proposition on the ballot soon. I think that is a wild and wonderful comment about how free thinking, how creative thinking, innovative thinking is really detrimental to the government's attempts to run over us.
That and the thinking makes people anxious, and that's why people don't like to think that much. So it doesn't take government much to prevent us from thinking. We want to do it ourselves. I think we have to look at ourselves first when it comes to why we do so little thinking.
I had a dream a few months back about Obama giving a speech, and the speech was about how complacent and non-thinking and vegetative the American public is, so it's really easy to put something over on them. But in this case, if people would read your book, they would know how they can step out and make a difference. So,
but they would still have to do it. You know, that's the problem with self-help books or good advice or other smart things that can be provided to people. They still have to do the work, and it's not so clear that most people want to do that work. So that's one of the unfortunate things about our species, is that in therapy, it's often said that first there's insight and then there's work. And it's one thing to provide people with insight, but then they have to do the work.
Well, why did you write this book?
Well, I've been working with creative performing artists for 25 years, and one of the things I noticed was that the productive artists could productively obsess, even if their life wasn't going well. And would-be artists could only unproductively obsess. They couldn't actually get to their work. So I figured that there was some distinction to be made there and something to investigate there. So I gathered some hundreds of people in cyberspace to work on the question of what's it like to create and nurture productive obsessions. And we've been working on that for a few years. And the book is an outgrowth of the idea that there are these things called productive obsessions. You may or may not know that about 100 years ago, the word obsession got hijacked by the clinical world. It got defined as an unwanted intrusive thought. As soon as you call all obsessions unwanted intrusive thoughts, you've stopped the conversation about the possibility of there being productive obsessions. But our writers and artists and scientists have known for thousands of years that there are productive obsessions, things you really want to bite into, things you really want to know about, things you really want to work on. So the main reason for doing the book was just to return the word obsession to the other side of the ledger and to remind people that, yes, there are unproductive obsessions that no one wants, but there are also productive obsessions that amount to the way that we make meaning in life.
Well, can you define obsession in the way you mean it?
I'm using it in a kind of brain-based way. There are many competing metaphorical ideas about how the brain works. Nobody really knows how the brain works, but there are lots of competing ideas. And one theory is what's called the neuronal gestalt model, which is just a fancy way of saying that to have a thought, neurons have to gather. And the more neurons that gather, and the longer they stay together, the bigger the thought we have. So I'm defining an obsession as a lot of neurons gathering together and staying together. We can have a quick insight where a lot of neurons gather together and suddenly we understand something better. But an obsession is when those thoughts stay in place for a long time and we continue to work on them. One simple example is a Beethoven hearing a folk tune in his 20s and holding it somewhere in consciousness, and it becomes a symphony in his 50s. The brain can do that. It can hold thoughts over time somewhere. And so that's what we're talking about here, is the brain-based idea of lots of neurons gathering to do work and staying together for a long amount of time. And the reason this is so difficult, the reason that most people can't get behind this idea, is that everybody's having too many small thoughts all day long. And every small thought steals neurons. Every small thought is 10 or 20 or 30 million neurons gathered to remember to pick up your kids at 3 or to announce to you that your lawn needs weeding or whatever. And as long as we have too many of these small thoughts, we don't have neurons freed to provide us with some big thinking. And that's what goes on for most people. They're just troubled by too many small thoughts and they can't get to their big thoughts.
So all of these thoughts coming together, you call that the brainstorm?
That's right.
Awesome. You know, this is kind of backwards from what we're taught. Like you said, right now, those people who are very obsessed or single-minded, we've kind of put them on the fringe, and you know, they're eccentric and they're strange.
Yeah, they produce all our good work.
I love that idea. So,
they do, because in order to do anything, I mean, to spend 2 years on a novel or 2 years on starting a home business or 2 years on anything that requires, you know, really putting your butt in the chair for a while, you know, you have to be obsessed to do it. Mere interest is not going to get you through the 2 years of writing your novel. Your mere interest is going to dissolve, you know, in 2 days. Virginia Woolf said that, you know, you start a novel with great enthusiasm and by the second day resignation sets in. You know, you're stuck having to do this real work. And that's why it takes something like productive obsessing to get any big thing done. Most people, and we're certainly not trained to obsess, just the opposite. We're trained to know small things. That's what school is about, knowing small things, knowing facts and dates and answers to tests. And so school doesn't help us learn about productive obsessions. And our family certainly doesn't either, because our family, naturally enough, has to collude with school, has to say to the kid, you know, if you want an A, you need to do the test. I don't want to hear about big ideas or you're writing your novel at 11. I don't want to hear about these things. You need to ace the test. So between school and the family and really all of our conservative institutions, conservative with a small c, all of our institutions that need to propagate themselves, we're stuck always having small thoughts from childhood on. So it takes really some new work to break that cycle and start to have some big thoughts.
Okay, we have some questions coming in from our audience on my email. And if you want to call in, the number is 347-850-1407. 347-850-1407. And remember, you have to push 1, put your hand up, say you want to talk. Or you can go to our chat room, which is at blogtalkradio.com. Sound Health Options is the show. And the chat is on the left down at the bottom, little green floating thing there. Just punch that and you can get into the chat room with us. You know, the question that just came in is, are you saying that we should ignore all the small thoughts? Who's going to do the dishes?
It's a great question. And what we argue for in the book is the idea of getting a better grip on your mind than you usually do. As the Buddha said, get a grip on your mind, and containing the obsession to an hour or two each day. It is absolutely the case that you must not productively obsess all the time, or you'll forget the names of your kids and you won't get your chores done and what have you. So I absolutely agree with with your listener. The idea is to start a morning practice. There are many reasons why it should be in the morning, but it can be any time of the day, but morning is a good time. to start a morning practice of an hour or 90 minutes, some amount of time, where you work on whatever it is you've decided to productively obsess about, whether it's writing your novel or starting your home business or solving a personal problem. Anything that you think is worth obsessing about, you contain it to that hour, hour and a half, and at the end of that time, you kind of ceremonially tell yourself, okay, this obsessing is wonderful, I'm having a great time, but I have the rest of life to live, and so I'm going to turn back to life and be responsible, be a good person, and get on with the rest of my life. That's the way you can have the best of both worlds, namely a productive obsession and a responsible life.
I got two things out of your book, and it may not be what you wanted to put in it at all, but the first thing I got is that everybody has a piece of genius, and with this system, you can bring that out.
I think that's true.
And the other piece was, there's a lot of stuff about self-forgiveness in this book, about forgiving yourself for things that oughta, shoulda, whatever, and that meant a lot to me.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have the experience of having disappointed themselves over time. They had dreams. You know, when we were 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, we had pure loves. You know, we knew we loved books or movies or music or nature or science. We just knew that with a kind of purity. And naturally that propelled us into maybe wanting to write a novel or wanting to be a scientist or something. And then maybe we tried it 19 times, you know, in our 20s. We gave it a shot. We gave it 3 days here and 5 days there. But we kind of knew we didn't give it our best shot. And so ultimately, in our 30s, 40s, 50s, we're carrying around a lot of disappointments about how we didn't quite live the life we had intended to live and how we haven't quite made ourselves proud. So we do have to forgive ourselves for all the ways in which maybe we didn't, you know, set the bar in the right place or didn't do what we needed to do and start fresh. We do have to start from today. And the starting place is the dual starting place of self-forgiveness and really getting on the horse. Just as coaches both provide support and accountability, you need people need self-support and self-accountability.
Well, just like the title, Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. I think that keyword, productive, really means a lot. Can you tell us how to get over being lazy, get over being addicted to TV, get over school brainwashing? How do we really start getting past other people looking at it and saying, okay, 2 hours a day, you could be doing something productive. You could be sweeping the carpet. What are the steps personally to get there, and what are the steps to keep other people off your back?
Let me start on the second part first, just so I don't forget it. And that is to speak out loud about things and try to negotiate and arrange, put it in quotation mark, contracts with the people in your family. It should not be preposterous that you get an hour to yourself from 5 to 6 in the morning. If anybody in your family believes that you should be on call sweeping the carpet from 5 to 6 in the morning, they need a really good lecture, because it's preposterous that you shouldn't have that hour. So I think you need to talk from a place of strength to the people around you. If people are not allowing you an hour or 2 hours to do something important to you, they need a little bit of a tongue reminder that isn't right. So I think clear communication and strong communication, assertive communication, is important there, because you don't want to be a person, you know, without a room of your own, without space, without the possibility of solitude and the possibility of thinking. You don't want to be that person. To get back to the first question, the main thing is to really decide that you're going to do something about your self-talk, that you're really going to notice what you're saying to yourself, and that you're going to dispute those utterances that don't serve you, and that you're going to substitute more affirmative language. That's the three-step process that cognitive therapists teach, and it really works if you're willing to do it. So if you notice that you're saying to yourself all the time, I'm too busy, I'm too busy, I'm too busy. Yeah, I'd like to write a novel, but I'm too busy. You have to know that that's actually self-defeating and self-sabotaging talk, and that you're going to dispute it. And you're going to say something like, yeah, I'm quite busy, but I'm not too busy to spend an hour on my novel. Only you can dispute your own utterances. And if you have been busily saying things to yourself for decades that don't serve you, you are the person who's going to have to interrupt that flow of negative self-talk or unuseful self-talk and change it. So that's the first step in this process of moving towards having productive obsessions, is noticing what you say to yourself and disputing those utterances that don't serve you and starting to substitute more affirmative language. The second step would be to even figure out what does interest you. A lot of people would say, if you had to quiz them right now, what interests you, they don't really know. They could tell you what they would do if they're given a free hour. They could tell you what TV show they might turn on. But that's not the same as actually knowing what interests you. So I think the second step is actually generating a list of your interests. And that may be hard to do because it may be a long time since you thought about what really interests you. To generate a list of those interests and to see if something on that list maybe wants to rise to the level of productive obsession. If there's something on that list you want to give a shot. And then the third step is the one we've been talking about, and that's making time for this obsession. Just an hour a day is plenty, but you need to make some time for the obsession. So just to go back over that, you have to get a grip on your own mind and your own self-talk. You have to try to figure out what really interests you, and then you have to make some time for it.
We have two other questions here. I'm trying to write all this down. This is good stuff. I'll do that in the summary. This great question. How can I tell the difference between being overboard, whacked out, and productive obsession?
There are no guarantees beforehand. You have to be able to monitor your own being. In my cyberspace group, I have people give their productive obsession 30 days because when you first start, you have no idea if it's just a mere interest or a bad idea or a good idea or what. There are no guarantees in life. There's only process. So you have to get started, and then you have to monitor your obsession as you go along. And I think 30 days is a good amount of time to give your obsession to see if it wants to rise from mere interest to something larger than that. As to whether you're going overboard, I think, again, you need to know. It's just like, you know, being a social drinker or an alcoholic. It's on your shoulders to know that, you know, one glass of wine every second day is fine and 26 glasses of wine a day isn't fine. It's on your shoulders to know that. So it's on your shoulders to know that an hour of productive obsessing each day is wonderful and forgetting your kids' names is not a good thing. So, again, I have to return control and responsibility to the individual.
Can you give us some examples of what you mean? Like somebody wants to open a cookie shop or write a book or design clothes. It's whatever their passion is?
Whatever their passion is. And I would say even just mere interest or hobby, because if you spend more time on a mere interest, that might rise to the level of obsession. But I'll give you an example from the book. We tried to find contemporary productive obsessions, not rehash the classical ones of, you know, Einstein obsessing about a unified field theory or Beethoven obsessing about symphonies. We thought that most people couldn't really relate to those particular obsessions. So we spent a lot of time just looking for normal, ordinary, contemporary, everyday obsessions. And one that comes to mind is a woman who didn't like the experience of books from 100 years crumbling under her fingers because they were all printed on paper with acid in them. And so her obsession became to have books published on acid-free paper, and she lobbied publishers and she made speeches, she talked about this issue. And now, as you probably know, most publishers will publish their books on acid-free paper. So her productive obsession actually changed an industry. And of course, I'm not saying that everybody's productive obsession is going to have that kind of effect in the world. But I think you can tell by the story what the flavor of a productive obsession is. It's you deciding that something's really important and doing the work required to go with that feeling of importance, whether it's an internal process of thinking about something and sitting there and writing, or whether it's an external process of lobbying for something and being an activist, whatever is required. That's how you know that you're really obsessed, is that you're doing the work.
Blogging really is going to be helping people with that.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that you have a cyber group. Would you talk about that a minute?
Sure. As I say, I gathered people together to see what it's like, what the process is really like of trying to create and nurture productive obsessions. So the group starts with me inviting people to do some of the work we've already been talking about, namely first silencing some of their busy mind so that they have some neurons available to even think, and then asking them, as I've said before, to try to generate a list of their interests to see, A, what interests them, and B, to have a list from which to select their next productive obsession. And then they go about the process of trying to productively obsess. They choose something to think about. They set aside the time. And what they discover is that they discover all kinds of things, but one of the things they discover is that by the second day, their interest doesn't interest them. They've been thinking about this for 26 years, that they really want to do X, and as soon as they spend 2 days on X, they discover that it never really interested them, that it was all kind of a romantic illusion. Well, then what do you have to do next? Obviously, you have to turn to your next prospective productive obsession, or else you're right back where you started, having nothing to think about. So one of the things we learn in the group is that if the productive obsession you've chosen doesn't actually interest you, that's not the end of the process. That's just a piece of the process. And then you have to pick your next productive obsession, try it out, and see if that interests you. So those are some of the things that we work on in the group.
Is this an open group? How do people get
in touch? It is an open group. People, if people are interested in this, they can drop me an email at ericmaisel@hotmail.com, and that's ericmaisel@hotmail.com.
And we have another email question. Can you give an example of replacing childhood-based negative thoughts?
Well, the process is exactly the one that I was describing before. Whether it's childhood-based or contemporary-based, it's that the thought is still there. So the two things that people are saying to themselves the most nowadays to avoid doing their work is I'm too busy and I'm too tired. And those aren't necessarily childhood-based. Those are just our ways, our contemporary ways of avoiding getting our work done. But there are all kinds of things that arise from childhood. Because I work with creative and performing artists, I hear all the time about some clarinet teacher when they were 7 saying that they had no chance as a musician, or some third grade English teacher saying that they had no imagination, or what have you. So people do have to get over hurts like that, injuries like that. They're actually traumas. They almost sound semi-innocent, like how could a third grade teacher's comment really harm you your whole life? But such comments can. And so you need to know that that happened. You need to be examining. You need self-awareness. You need to know that that comment is still hurting you, and then you need to talk yourself away from the sting. If you hear yourself saying, boy, I have no imagination, the next thing you need to say is, wow, that comes from my third grade teacher. That's a thought that doesn't serve me, and I no longer intend to countenance it. I refuse to have that thought. And then you need to substitute more affirmative language, which would sound like, of course I have imagination. The more you keep saying, of course I have imagination, as opposed to, boy, I have no imagination, over time, you'll extinguish those thoughts that have arisen in childhood or that have arisen in contemporary times. The idea is not to always be arm-wrestling these thoughts to the ground. That's a lot of heavy lifting, a lot of labor. The idea is to actually extinguish them. And by doing this work of noticing and disputing and substituting, you can extinguish all the negative language over time.
And sometimes the people who are saying that to you, it's for an entirely different reason than what the words express. I'd like to give an example from my own life. When I was in high school, our guidance counselor told my parents that I was not smart enough to go to college. And when I went to college and graduated, I graduated with a 4.0. And so I went back to this guidance counselor. I said, why did you say that to my parents, that I was not intelligent enough? And she said, I knew they were so poor that there was no chance of you ever going to college.
Exactly.
And I said to her, well, what about scholarships? And she just didn't have any answer. She didn't look.
Yeah. Or why not say it that way, if that's what you mean? If you say she's very bright, but probably you'll have money troubles. I mean, why not say it that way, as opposed to, you know, it's just a very insulting, demeaning, and hurtful way of saying a thing.
Yes, it was. I had a complex about it. I'm getting another message here. I had a complex about it for years that I wasn't smart enough.
Exactly. And I think an awful lot of people, especially people who haven't managed to fulfill themselves. Otto Rank was a psychoanalyst who followed Freud, and he was one of the few psychologists who was actually interested in artists. And he quoted the term, he made up the term, artist manqué, which meant an artist who never quite managed to become an artist, somebody who'd always had it in her heart to be an artist but didn't quite pull it off. I think that person especially is going to find a whole bevy of those kinds of wounds in her history, and she's going to need to heal them in order to proceed.
My chat room is not allowing me to type, and so to the question, do you know what a Snowball 87 is? Yes, and I'll answer that after the show for you. We have somebody calling in. I'm going to put them on the air. Okay, you're on the air, and I can't really tell you what your phone number is because you have hidden it, but your hand is up, so go ahead. Somebody who had their hand up, go ahead and talk.
Hi, I think, is that me? Can you hear
yes.
me? Hi, sorry about that. I forgot. In California, we automatically block numbers usually, and so I forgot to unblock. I apologize. But thank you for the show. And my question, I was trying to think of an example, and I can't come up with one this morning, but my question is basically, how would one know the difference between sort of a dream slash obsession longing that is realistic and one that is not?
By the way, is this a voice I know?
No. Mm-mm.
Oh, I'm sorry, because you sound like someone I know well, so I won't say who you are because you're not that person.
No, we've never met.
Okay. You can't know beforehand. This is the truth about process, that it's very difficult for people to understand this truth about process. You have to actually engage with the process to have some understanding about whether the thing is valuable or not valuable, whether it works or doesn't work. Things really ought not to be dismissed beforehand too cavalierly. It's much better to start something and try to complete it than to dismiss it beforehand as unrealistic or too large or too whatever. You know, people who claim to know will say that Beethoven's 1st, 3rd, 5th, 7th, and 9th symphonies are better than his 2nd, 4th, 6th, and 8th, and I have no idea if that's true or not. But I know that you can't do 9 without 8, you can't do 8 without 7. You can't skip the things that don't work. And that's what every human being kind of wants to skip the things that don't work.
Mm.
And we can't do that. The truth about process is we can't skip the things that don't work. Only a percentage of the things we try are actually going to work. So that's a long-winded way of saying there's no guarantees beforehand, and there's actually no way of knowing beforehand. It's better to jump in and give something a month or 2 months of your time than to try to sit there and make some determination beforehand about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea.
That's interesting. It's a great answer, and I think my question, I probably didn't formulate it succinctly or clearly enough for what I'm trying to get at, which I think is maybe it connects with obsession can be very perfectionist and can be the idea that would say, I want to be the world's greatest, you know, I want to be number one on the bestseller list, as opposed to I want to write a novel and just have that experience.
That's right. You've said it beautifully. And all I would say is I would just restate what you said in a more general way, and that is to engage in process and not attach to outcomes. I think that's the way I would say it. You want to engage in process, just as you say, you want to sit down and write the novel, but you do not want to attach to outcomes like this is going to be a bestseller or this is going to be published or this is going to make my fame or this is going to allow me to quit my day job. You want to be ambitious, passionate, eager, enthusiastic, but not attached to outcomes. And it's a very hard dance for human beings to figure out, this dance of attachment and detachment simultaneously, because that's what it is. You're simultaneously attaching, that is, you're saying, this is important work to me, and simultaneously detaching and saying, I don't know where this is going to go. I don't know if this is going to work out. I'm not going to put my brain cells in the direction of writing my Nobel Prize-winning speech right now. I'm going to sit here and work on my novel.
Right, realistic, non-perfectionist, in the moment process. Well, I like the way you said it, process, not...
attaching to outcomes. That's right.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let me give you a sort of strange example. If you have a two-week vacation each year and you decide to spend it in a place where the sun shines 362 days a year and you show up and it's raining, you're going to have a bad vacation if you overattach to the need for sunshine, and you're going to have a good vacation if you instantly decide how you're going to spend your time in the rain.
Mm-hmm.
And most people are over-attached to needing that sunshine, and they're going to bitch for those 3 days about, you know, the sun not shining. So it's work on ourselves to be in control of our mind enough that when the plane lands and we see it's raining, we have a place to go in our own mind about how to make that an okay vacation.
Great. Thank you, Eric.
You're welcome.
I think we have to think, too, about what we want as a result. Here's a really quick one. If I'm writing you a letter and you don't write back, do I write again? Do I write again? Do I write again if you don't write back? What's my intention? Is it to give you the news of the day from me, or is my intention really to get you to write back? So we
That's right. It's a great question. By the way, that actually quite parallels what I have to work on with creative and performing artist clients about, let's say, writing to a literary agent and hearing nothing. It's exactly the kind of question that arises in an artist's life all the time as they try to send work out into the world, and mostly the response they most often get is silence. So are they supposed to, quote, badger the person more, pester the person? Are they supposed to give up? These are real questions in the lives of creative performing artists.
We have another audience question. Often when I'm exercising, my mind takes on this brainstorm that you're talking about. Is that the same kind of thing? Because often it answers questions that's been plaguing me from the days before.
You bet. That's when you go into that kind of trance state, whether it's the trance of working or even the trance of doing the dishes. All of Agatha Christie's plots for her novels came to her as she was doing the dishes. When we go into that kind of dreamy state, what's happening is that we're not having our small thoughts. We're actually detaching the grip of neurons from all those small thoughts, and we're getting our whole brain back. And what that experience feels like is a certain kind of emptiness, certain kind of quiet and emptiness. And in that quiet and emptiness, answers arise, big ideas arise. So that's exactly right. That's, of course, though, only a first step. Having that big idea while you're exercising is only a first step. You then have to elaborate it. You have to do the work that follows. If it's a good idea for a novel, you then have to write the novel. Of course, if you've solved a problem, then you're done. But most often, what that thought is a good idea for something, and then you have to follow through on that good idea. But that's exactly right. When we're doing things which put us into a trance state, we get our whole brain back, and that's when our big ideas arise.
Richard, you had a question.
Yes. Eric, could you speak a little more about that? What I think is a really powerful idea is that part where you were speaking about replacing what I call the negative thought or the obsessive thought about a negative point in your childhood and beginning to chink away at that with the process of, instead of, I'm fat and everybody called me fat, and the obsession that builds around that as a child, and how you begin to, what I'm terming is chink away at that and changing that into a different kind of thought?
Well, I think you've just said it beautifully. I'm not sure that I would add anything except the notion that we're much trickier creatures than we understand. And so it's rare that we say things as straightforward to ourselves as, I'm not talented. More often we're saying, I'm too busy, rather than, I'm not talented. So I think we have to get darn expert at noticing the language we use and how it operates and how our language is keeping us from doing the things we intend to do. If we were always saying things as straightforward as, I'm not talented, it would be easier to dispute those utterances. But when we say things that are so tricky and so disguised that they sound just like the truth, I'm tired, sounds just like the truth, or I'm busy, sounds just like the truth, as long as we're saying things that sound just like the truth, we have to be extra good at being our own detective at understanding our language.
Mm-hmm. Does that help, Richard?
That's really powerful, the focus. I know for me that's turned around a lot. I spend a lot of time, talking. This is what I do. People, I interview people and talk to people. So I've learned to really listen to the words and listen to what people are saying. So for myself, that's sort of where I've taken some of my obsession and focus it, is on listening to the power of words and listening to how do we not only speak to each other, but how we speak. And that's such a fascination for me, and that's part of how I've turned some of my stuff, rather than issues, I'll just call it stuff, around,
I absolutely agree, and that's why when I work with clients, I work as a coach with, as I say, creative and performing artists, I'll interrupt them in the first minute of our first conversation when I hear a phrase that I need to identify as their particular trickiness. So I entirely agree that probably the main quality or skill of a good therapist or coach is not only to listen carefully, I think that goes without saying, but to call people on their language, to say, wow, you just said this, that's very interesting. By saying that, I bet that that leads you to doing X, Y, and Z in your life. Does that really serve you to say that? Does it really serve you to say that you can only perform in a room that's at 68 degrees? Gee, that's interesting. Does that really serve you to say that? Et cetera.
I think it's really great that you call it tricky. I think it's a wonderful word, and I think it's really great that you call it tricky. I think that's just so perfect.
Thank you.
It's so true about our brain, how tricky it can be.
Because we're trying to not have the experience of anxiety. That's what we're doing. We don't like the experience of anxiety. We have enough of it already. We don't like the experience of anxiety. So rather than saying, I don't want to perform today, it makes me anxious to perform, we say, boy, there's not a very big audience here today. I don't think it's worth me performing. So what our language is attempting to do is to shield us from the experience of anxiety. I tell my clients they're going to have to embrace anxiety. They have to stop running from it. They have to embrace it. Then they can manage it once they embrace it. But they have to understand that anxiety is part of the process of living. And if they try to run from it, if they try to flee from it, then their language is going to do the kinds of tricky things that we've been talking about.
You say that about depression, too, about enjoying and using your own depression. We only have 3 minutes left.
Let's not go to depression then, because that's more than 3 minutes.
I want to say to people before we leave that Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions by Eric Mazel is available. It's on sale at Amazon, 4.5 stars. It's on sale $4 off here, so that's great. And Eric, can you give us a website where people can get in touch with you?
Sure, there are two websites. There's one directly for the book if you want to learn more about the book, and that's brainstormthebook.com. And then there's my personal website where you can learn about my services and my trainings and what have you, and that's ericmaisel.com, and that's ericmaisel.com.
We have 4 really good questions. We've got 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll talk really fast.
Wait a second. When the 2 minutes are up, I'll just do a normal sign-off. But we'll keep going. It'll be in the archives because these are good questions. A question about with this, I think one of the reasons people aren't going for this is they're being forced to choose between satisfaction and money. Good question.
Absolutely, but the idea here is not to make that choice because I'm telling you to keep your day job, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
This productive obsession is just for that hour in the morning. And there's no reason why you can't work on your novel for that hour, even if it never makes you a cent. Even if, you know, we're talking about not attaching to outcomes, why not just try and see if you can make yourself proud by spending that 1 hour and writing that novel? It's really an hour that you would probably turn over to something not that interesting anyway. So that is an important question about making life decisions about, let's say, choosing to be a poet or an accountant. Those are absolutely big life decisions. But that's not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about here is make your life decisions about how to make money separate from the productive obsession. You can have a productive obsession, so to speak, in the morning and make money in the afternoon.
Well, we are out of time. Thank you, Eric Mazel, author of Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. We're going to sign off now for our Blog Talk Radio audience, but we'll try to continue with our conversation with Eric.
But actually, I must go at the hour to start working with clients, even though it's Sunday. So I must sign off, too.
Okay, well, I will send you these questions. They are great ones.
Great, thank you.
So for those of you who want to stay on and talk a bit with us, we will do that. Thank you, Eric, for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Please join us at guardiansofthepeople.com for our next class, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. Thank you for being with us. Okay, Eric has signed off now. the other questions I thought were really good. Maybe we can talk. What in our society caused us to lose this ability to be creative like that? Do we have too much stimulation from TV and radio and other sorts? I thought that was a good question. Are there absolute steps you must follow? Well, no, according to Eric, there isn't.
Can we back up to that first question for a second?
What in our society caused people to lose this ability?
Yes. Do you think that part of it is that we moved out of a phase of, well, actually, into the technological phase where we're not only overstimulated, what I would also call over-adrenalized, by constant stimulation, and the fact that because of where our society is at monetarily and what it takes, that we're also over-adrenalized. Do you think that there's part of this tendency to obsess is also a hormone imbalance or a state of adrenal fatigue?
I don't know. Sometimes I think it's just laziness. I love...
Okay.
I love just thinking.
Yeah, me too. Oh, yeah, I'm obviously or evidently a thinker, so yeah.
But my husband absolutely loves just to sit there and vegetate and watch sports, even if he's already seen it. He'll watch the same show again or a rerun, especially of tennis matches. It's just something to fill up his time. But he has two TVs, and they're within 4 feet of each other. So on one TV, he can watch like two or three stations at once, and then over here, a totally different one's cable and one's local. And then in the middle, he has music, and that would just absolutely drive me crazy. There's no room for that kind of external garbage in my life. I need quiet so my brain can think, and on many levels at once. My problem is every time I'm working anywhere, I have 4 or 5 projects at once, because here come a thought, and there's a thought, and that belongs over here, and this belongs over here. I think I am a successful ADD, but I think that we have a natural talent for that, and we've lost the ability with sit here in this class and concentrate on this and don't do anything else and don't ask a question that's out of what we're talking about. And, you know, school, I think, has really ruined a lot of people.
Well, I think, you know, naturally, if we think about how we came out of the caves, you know, if we want to go back, I always like to go back to sort of the basic sort of lizard mind concept. Even in the days of when all our life really consisted of is, you know, getting out of the cave, going out and either finding food or water and getting back into the cave alive, that still took a lot of multitasking actions to get out of the cave, monitor everything around you at all times so something didn't swoop down and claw, you know, grab you and eat you, or something didn't come lumbering along and step on you and not even know you were there. I mean, there was still a lot of multitasking monitoring going on, so I think by nature our brains are multitasking oriented.
My husband's father was a child psychologist, and he refused to let his children do anything fun until all the work was done. So he trained them to do that for 18 years, but now for the next 50 here, I've been having to live with, well, I've been choosing to live with that, because he will do everything entertaining first before he does any work. So what
right.
good did it do for his father to try to instill that in him?
Yeah.
It really didn't work. It totally backfired. And I am very close to, I should just say, I have one daughter who is a homeschooler and one daughter who is a school superintendent, so I've got it on both ends here. But I see the homeschooling mother really cultivates her kids' curiosity, and they are far advanced. And then the other daughter is worrying about her students passing some tests that the government made up that they don't really know what the curriculum is. So it's, I think the schools do a lot of damage in this. I think peer pressure does a lot of damage. And your boss, you can only do this in this way. Well, I don't want creativity. You just sit there and do what I tell you. You know, squelching other people's creativity is a horrible thing. I'm thinking of so many things at once. One of the things that happens here when we bring new people on board is that we have to untrain them to blame somebody else. One of our mottos here is one of the most egregious things that somebody could do is blame somebody else for their mistakes. And it really is hard to train people to say, yes, I made that mistake, yes, I'll undo it, or yes, we can do this to fix it. Because they will do everything in their power not to be blamed for something. That idea that Eric was talking about, self-responsibility, really, we train people to lie and to say, you know, it wasn't me, not me, not me. There's even cartoons, you know, about that, not me. So instilling that back, that self-responsibility, I think is really important. You know, another one, Richard. Well, thank you. Another one. Was there ever a time when it was okay to be a little nuts?
Yeah.
The shaman of the tribe, you know, how their mind worked. This, and it must be an innate ability in us that society and coming together to live together in conformity sort of bred out of us.
It sort of squeezed it out because of the societal pressure to fit in. Well, especially, I'll go on a rant. I was gonna, you know, there's
go
the whole religious fanatic. Well, there's the whole religious fanatic thing. Well, you know, it's not. This has nothing to do with religion in the sense of God belief. It has to do with the parameters that religious belief systems would force people into. That, you know, I won't pick on any particular group, but it's just you have to look a certain way, you have to act a certain way, you have to be a certain thing to fit into the group. And if you're not, well, that's, you know, I'm much more of the shaman. I relate to the shaman. I'm a little wacky at any given moment, and all the people that I know that of me, and they like that part of me because I'm a free-form thinker. But there's this attempt to put people into boxes and make them be certain ways, and it always seems to, at some point down the road, it seems to backfire, and when it does, it's not pretty.
When people get in trouble, do they come to you for innovative ideas?
Yes.
Yeah. I do map dowsing a lot, and there was a little girl missing.
Mm-hmm.
And this family came to me and wanted me to help them find their daughter. But before they came in my house, they said, you have to promise me that you won't tell anybody we've been here. It just was crazy.
Yeah.
But I found her, told her where she was and who she was with, and they denied it and got mad and stomped out. You know, and 2 days later in the paper, there it was. That's exactly where they found her. So that ability to be in two places or three places at once and to be a shaman, and I think with TV and telephone and all of those things, we forgot to practice being a little nuts and being a little crazy and thinking I need to go see such and such and acting on it. We're so dependent now on pick up the phone. Oh, you okay? Oh, all right. No, yeah. Do I need to come over? Whatever. So I think practicing this old, I think what he's talking about is an altered state of consciousness, this free-flowing. There's really not a whole lot new in this book, but it puts into perspective some ideas that I think are innate and nobody thought to write about before.
Right. I liked his, the material, since I didn't actually read the book, but I read a lot about him, and I read a number of articles he'd written, and I read a bunch of and listened to some interviews he'd done before. And the part that I like is that it is I believe is his foundation. He might be a Taoist, and so it does have a foundational thing about quieting the mind, which I think is powerful, even though I'm not a direct meditator myself, not in the classic way. But I think quieting that space, having a space anywhere where it's, you know, just quiet for a while, is fabulous, and that it's a very somewhat methodical approach to getting control or changing thoughts. That was the part I was really interested in querying him about, was the idea of, you know, finding a thought, listening to your self-talk, and then just taking one little piece of that self-talk and beginning to break it apart and change it.
Mm-hmm.
And then once that changes, then that the cascade effect, I don't know that he talks about this, but the cascade of changing that one thought will bump into other thoughts that have been created off that false belief, and then things can begin to break apart. And I think that's really powerful. And so there's a lot of stuff that he is talking about that does give a good approach to, rather than the sort of some paradigms where the, you know, the, what's that called, behavior modification approach, which is just, well, if that hurts, stop doing it.
Yes. You know, one of the other things somebody wrote in was, are there people you can name who are examples of what you're advocating? You know, I would think of Bill Gates, Stephen King, but in each of those cases, those two people are sort of introverts and had to have a wife there as a foundation, but they were obsessed and very productively obsessed. But in the beginning, in each case, I mean, how many times was Stephen King's novels rejected before somebody wised up?
Steve Jobs is another one where, you know, I mean, somebody who's completely possessed about an idea. I mean, and actually I'm using possessed, not just obsessed, actually possessed about the idea of how something should be done. Right or wrong, well, actually he and Gates are very similar that way, I think, where they're possessed, obsessed, but I really, as I say, I'm saying possessed, which seems more powerful than just obsessed even, about how something needs to be done, and that's what's made them where they are today. Following that obsession or possession.
And you have to not care what other people think about how nutty you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's a question that came in from Marjorie, and I don't know what it depends on, but I think it's a nice question we should talk about. Do you think we depend too much on being nice to each other? I totally get run over by salespeople and people asking for money because I don't know how to say no. I don't know what that has to do with brainstorming, except she could run through those scenarios in her head and think of very creative things, you know, hindsight. But that's a good question. We depend on, these salespeople depend on people to be nice on the phone instead of just saying, did I give you permission to call me?
Well, I think also salespeople are, this is so topical for me, because just yesterday I was walking away from a store in a shopping center, and I had somebody come up to me who was selling knockoff perfume. And she was very nice. You know, it was just a street vendor kind of person. And she was very pleasant about it. She had a backpack, and I could see, I read her immediately. Well, that's a whole other thing. But I read her just by watching what she had been doing. And when she walked up to me and started to give me her spiel, I just said, no, not interested, thank you. And that was it. It just stopped it right there. Sometimes you... I think part of it is that you have to be okay with the possibility that somebody might reject you or be pissed off because you say no. You have to be comfortable with that part that Eric was talking about with the giving up attachment to the outcome.
I would hate to be a cold call salesperson. That to me,
I'd
rather perform surgery or something.
I'd be much better at performing surgery than I would doing cold call, actually. Yeah, absolutely.
I think that is, one other question, absolute steps that must be followed. No, he said there's none. Just find a time to be quiet and think about what you want to think about. So I think we got all of the questions. Oh, is this what shamans used to do? I would think so. Do you have anything to add except asking people to join us for Guardians, the next class? August 15th.
Absolutely, join us for Guardians. I'm excited to hear that Sound Health Options is now up and happening. That's very exciting. And join us on Guardians. And everything is already posted to the drop.io/nanovoice. I also added a link with some information about Eric's book, Brainstorm, there.
This is great. A lot of people stuck with us. So thank you for continuing to listen to us talk about what it's like to be human. You know, one of the things that Buckminster Fuller said, I hope I can find it here because it's too long for me to remember, but it was about, in order to change something, don't struggle to change the existing model. Create a new model and make the old one obsolete. And I think in the face of Obamacare, that the idea of bioacoustics is that new change. So I would encourage all of you, I would love it if all of you could join us on Guardians of the People and our classes. We're going to be doing some marketing this time, too, in addition to the post-traumatic stress disorder. So please join us. Thank you, Richard, for being with us. I am going to... the show is
Stop
on
the show.
Streaming, so I don't know how to quit. I guess
well,
I will just
it seems like
to...
there's a thing there where you... Can you stop the stream, or...
No.
It... Hang up. I guess we just all hang up.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye.